supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight, broadcasting from Ocean City, New Jersey, in preparation for the Memorial Day weekend. Dave Heller is off tonight. Let's first focus on Philadelphia. The water pipes running under Philadelphia are old and leaky, and the city's water department has been working to replace them block by block. But for some residents, that work has turned their streets into muddy construction sites for months on end. Jim Saska of WHYY's Plan Philly has this report.
2300 block Mole Street has been completely stripped. All of the concrete that was here has been pulled up, and what's been left is dirt, and rocks, and loose gravel. You don't stroll down Mole Street anymore, you hike it.
The Philadelphia Water Department started replacing water mains and sewers on Mole Street in January. For months, residents have lived on a dirt road with no sidewalks. Residents understand the work is necessary. These cast iron pipes were installed sometime before the Civil War. They need replacing. And that's not a quick and easy job. Here's Water Department spokesman Joe DiGiulio.
An average time to replace a water main is 1 month. The average time to replace a sewer is about 3 to 4 months. So if we're going to be working water main and sewer main on a block, it could take 4 to 5 months.
The department wants to replace 40 miles of mains and sewers a year. For efficiency's sake, they group blocks together, a couple at a time, into one job. That saves time and money overall, but it means delays for each individual street.
We won't pave one block at a time. We will pave when all the paving is ready to be done on all the jobs. It's not cost efficient to bring in a paving company to pave one block, come back again a couple months later, pave another block.
On top of the slow pace, residents complain that the work has damaged their stoops and flooded their basements. And the worst part is not knowing when the work will finally end, says resident Ryan Murphy.
While the project was ongoing, that was the only notice that we were given, were these no parking signs. So if you look down at this telephone pole, there's one, it might say January 10th to be determined.
The water department mails two notices before construction starts and hand delivers a third. But those notices address work in the general area, not an individual street. And according to the post office, only about half of Americans still read their mail. Jim Saxa, WHYY News.
Across the United States, more than 2 million people work in energy efficiency. It makes up the largest sector of the nation's clean energy workforce. Virginia McGrath has held one of those jobs for 3 years. She's an energy auditor for Pittsburgh's Conservation Consultants Incorporated. She says the conservation surrounding her work is challenging.
I think that the energy efficiency field has made a transition. Instead of saving energy and saving money, we're talking about making a home safer and more comfortable. I think that resonates with people a little bit more.
Lately, she spent a lot of time at a subdivision near Mars, a borough in Butler County. For State Impact Pennsylvania's Voices of Energy series, McGrath shares her story while she inspects a newly built home.
Hello. There's no one living in this home currently. They're closing, I believe, next week, Wednesday. The builders are having me come in to make sure that all of the energy efficiency installations that they've done are done well and that they didn't miss anything. Anywhere where wire or plumbing penetrations are coming in, they would want to be air sealed. So these should have a bead of caulk around them. I'm gonna just take a picture. And then you see how there's spray foam on this side, not on this side. So it's just little things like that that I'm looking for. This is just something I'm going to note, and they might come back and do it, or they might not. We'll see. I really enjoy being able to see the difference that I'm making. So if I go to a home and do an energy audit and recommend that they get insulation or they do these air sealing measures, and then I go back and do a post inspection, I get to actually see the difference that it's made in their home. And I know that that's going to save them money, make their home more comfortable, but it's also going to reduce that home's reliance on fossil fuels. So this is probably like a more awkward piece of equipment. This is the blower door. There's a test that I'm going to do. It's an air leakage test. So I'll be sucking all the air out of the house and then being able to see where air leakage might be coming in. All right, well, let's start it up. To put this in perspective, this home is probably similar size to mine, and my house was built in 1900 though, and I do this for a living, so my house is pretty airtight and it's insulated pretty well, but my blower door reading is like 3200, so almost twice as much as this house. And that's just something it's really hard to get with the older homes, unless you're totally gutting them and redoing them yourself and redoing them with energy efficiency in mind. So I did recently start flipping houses. It's been an adventure. I want to put my knowledge that I have towards energy efficiency into these homes. And I want to make these old, dilapidated Pittsburgh homes as energy efficient as possible.
That was Virginia McGrath. Her story was produced by Amy Sisk for State Impact Pennsylvania, a collaboration between WHYY, WITF, WESA, and the Allegheny Front to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. To hear more voices of energy, visit State Impact Pennsylvania online. Memorial Day weekend marks the unofficial start of summer. More importantly, it's time to honor those who died in service to the country. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, to gain insight on sentiments towards service members.
Frank, how is the military regarded by the American public?
Generally very positive. I often contrast the confidence Americans have in the military with the confidence that Americans have in Congress. Military is at the top of the list. It has been for 20 straight years now. When Gallup asks Americans to rate their confidence in a long list of institutions, right now, we have a 72% confidence rating for the military among Americans. It's higher than small business, which comes in second. Congress, as I mentioned before, is down in the teens in terms of confidence in Congress. So you can see the huge contrast there. There was a point when 85% of Americans had confidence in the military, and that came back in 1991, I should point out, right after the Persian Gulf War with first President Bush. That's the highest we've ever measured it. But as I mentioned, over the last several decades, year after year, Americans have more confidence in the military than any other major institution that we measure.
Frank, the draft ended in 1973. And as of now, what percent of Americans can say they've served in the military?
11.5%. Now, that's men and women together. When we separate out men, it's about 20% of men. One out of five men tell us that they are veterans. Among women, it's 3%. Now, as you mentioned, the draft ended in the early 70s, so when we go back in time, once we get to people who are in their mid-60s, men who are in their mid-60s, and then older, the percent who are veterans begins to go up and up and up. About half of men 65-plus say they're veterans, and when we get, Dave, into the 80 and over population, that percent is well over 60%. So a lot of older people, Vietnam veterans and back, Korean War, World War II, are veterans. But more recently, relatively few people, Americans, are veterans because we have a volunteer army and most individuals no longer serve.
Frank, the NFL this week announced its new policy regarding protocol during the playing of the national anthem. What's your latest polling on protest during the pregame ceremony?
Probably the most recent poll was conducted by the Washington Post that showed a little over half, 53% of Americans, said it was not appropriate for players to kneel during the anthem, which presumably would go along with the recently announced NFL policy about kneeling during the anthem in football games for NFL players. I think one of the most salient findings, however, from all the polling on this is how divisive it is. If you're a minority, particularly African Americans, overwhelmingly you say it's perfectly okay to kneel. Younger people, certainly much more likely than older Americans as well, to say that it's okay to kneel. And also Democrats and liberals more likely to say that it's okay than Republicans. So this is one of many issues which really divides Americans, at least based on the most recent polling.
Another divisive issue is abortion. And the Trump administration last week announced that federal funding will be withheld from health clinics that promote abortion. Let's take up attitudes on that and other so-called values issues.
Each year we ask Americans to rate the state of values in this country today. The overall state of moral values is how we phrase it, and it's pretty terrible. And this is pretty consistent, Dave, which I think is interesting, because we are becoming more liberal as a country on a number of issues, and we'll probably be discussing those in the weeks ahead. Things like premarital sex, sex between teenagers, unmarried men and women having sex, same-sex marriage, legalized marijuana, a number of things where Americans have become more liberal. But consistently, even as that's happening, Americans tell us in our poll that, oh, moral values in this country are horrible. In fact, only 1% of Americans in the poll we just finished said that the overall state of moral values in America today are excellent. 13% say good. So that's just 14%. Everybody else is only fair, and about half of Americans say poor. And 77% of Americans say that moral values are getting worse, not better, in this country today. So we've got a lot of paradoxes going on here. Americans getting more liberal on a lot of values and social issues. At the same time, they decry the state of moral values in this country.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
Fun Home, a show about a family whose father owns a funeral home, is a coming-out story, both for the father and his daughter. It's also a true story. The daughter is a graphic novelist, Allison Bechdel, raised in tiny Beach Creek, Pennsylvania, not far north of Penn State. That's where Fun Home, winner of the 2015 Tony Award for Best Musical, is set. WHYY's Howard Shapiro has this review of the show.
Just after Fun Home begins, we get the plot synopsis from its main character.
My dad and I both grew up in the same small Pennsylvania town, and he was gay, and I was gay, and he killed himself. And I became a lesbian cartoonist.
That's local theater artist Mary Tuominen, who plays the adult Allison Bechdel in a masterly performance at the Arden. It's Bechdel's account of her small-town upbringing, her coming out as a gay woman, and of her father's downfall as a not-so-tightly-closeted gay man who's arrested after he hits on a young man the family knows. Bechdel's memoir was a critically acclaimed graphic novel. Then it became a musical, eventually on Broadway. It's made up of short scenes written by the playwright Lisa Krohn, with a score by her and the noted composer Janine Tesori. All three performers who play Allison at different stages of her life have their moments in song, along with a cast that includes three impressive kids. But it's not the score that moves me, it's the scenes, directed for maximum impact by the Arden's leader, Terrence J. Nolan. One is a startling interchange between young Allison and her father, played by Ben Dibble. She's drawing a perfectly fine map for her grade school project, and her demanding and constantly irritated father insists that she change it to his own drawing style. It's his way or the highway, which is where, we learn early on, he will end his life standing in front of an oncoming truck. In another scene, she prepares for a party, and the last thing she wants is a dress and party shoes, but in the end, she needs to please her curt father. Other scenes also point to a father-daughter relationship so fragile that when it breaks, you wonder what took so long. It clearly begins to crack when Allison goes off to Oberlin College and discovers her sexuality after spending a night with a student named Joan. Here's Izzy Castaldi playing Allison as a student.
I am writing a thesis on Joan.
It's a cutting-edge field, and my mind is blown. I would gladly stay up every night to hone my compulsory skills with Joan.
Fun Home is in a category you could call therapeutic musical theater. These shows like Spring Awakening, Next to Normal, and the current Broadway hit Dear Evan Hansen aren't intentionally meant as therapy, but they speak frankly to people who've experienced something similar to what the characters go through. And these people sometimes see the shows again and again. I know a New Yorker who visited Fun Home on Broadway so many times I stopped counting after five. Some people are smitten by its stunningly honest depiction of gay self-discovery. For my friend, the fragile father-daughter experience was the catch. This is musical theater with great power, and the Arden production shows why. It runs through June 17th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
Beach season is here, and for many that means days spent meandering down the boardwalk in Ocean City, New Jersey. Dean Davis is the author of The Ocean City Boardwalk, 2.5 Miles of Summer, a coffee table book that serves as a photographic essay of the beach city. He joins us now for a dip into seaside history. Dean, what's so unique about the city known as America's Family Resort?
Well, Ocean City is a wonderful place to visit for those who have not been there. It's very family-oriented, and this book focuses on just the boardwalk itself because there is so much to do there. And when my family and I vacation there, it seems that we spend 95% of our time on the boardwalk in some capacity. So I just wanted to capture those images and go from a historical perspective, which a couple of the chapters do have more of a way things were decades ago, and bring it up to today.
Now, one of the grand dames that continues to survive in Ocean City is the Flanders Hotel. For people who haven't seen it, describe it and describe why it's so, I want to say, grand.
Well, the Flanders is quite unique. It was built in the late 20s. It survived quite a few things that happened between fires and hurricanes on the boardwalk. The boardwalk actually used to go right up to the Flanders, and then after the big fire that they had in, I believe it was the mid-20s, that's where they built it, closer to the beach itself. And it's quite a unique place, the architectural style and such. Matter of fact, if anyone has been to the Boardwalk Resort in Disney World, that a large part of that was modeled off of the Flanders. Disney sent a bunch of Imagineers up there for a period of time. They stayed at the Flanders, drew sketches, took pictures, then worked those architectural details into the Boardwalk Resort.
Any odd experiences when you were shooting this book?
Yeah, there was more fear of heights than I'd like to have admitted to. A lot of roof climbing. I was on the Flanders roof, which was, you had to get to through a little skylight in one of the penthouse rooms. That was interesting. And then the music pier, they were also very helpful and allowed me to climb on their roof to get some shots. So you do see those shots in the book. And one of the odd experiences was you had to climb out the men's room window, then use this old rickety ladder they had for maintenance on the main roof of the music pier. And as I was climbing back down and going back through the window, unfortunately, two gentlemen were using the facilities, and here I come climbing through with a camera and a telephoto lens and had to explain what I was doing as I was climbing back through the window of the restrooms.
Well, the interesting thing about the music pier is it's that and the fishing pier are the only two things that jut out past the boardwalk.
Correct. The other ones would be the some of the rock formations, I guess. I mean, these are obviously man-made. One of those juts out around 4th Street, and that's actually where both covers of the book was shot. The first cover was shot by a gentleman named Rich Updike. He helped me with the first edition. Unfortunately, he's passed away. He actually passed away before the first edition reached print, but the second edition, which this one is, I took the shot, and I went out to the same place where he was. And the interesting thing about it is you can see pretty much the 2.5 miles of the boardwalk. It's from 4th Street, and you can clearly see on up to 17th Street. And it's interesting to see how some of the buildings, and especially the rides near Wonderland, have changed over the 10 years.
And it is a true expedition into the changing face of society and especially the Shore communities. I mean, over 10 years, things have almost completely turned over. When you look at that Shore area, a lot of the housing stock has changed, and so has the face of the boardwalk.
Oh, completely. There's things that are in this edition and the previous edition that I couldn't control by the time the book went to print, and we did print within a year. You know, these things have either, like, been torn down or restructured or completely just gone. What I get when I do various signings is people say, oh, I'm so glad you took the picture of this because, you know, my children loved it when they were growing up, and now it's not there anymore. So it was very nice to do. And I also had the Historical Society and another gentleman help me with various postcards and histories around the town, and especially the boardwalk with the movie theaters and such. So it was something I tried to cover throughout the decades, not just that immediate period of time.
Dean Davis, the book's title, The Ocean City, New Jersey Boardwalk, 2.5 Miles of Summer. That's the way we're kicking off our summer here on Newsworks Tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Very enjoyable, and I wish everyone gets to see Ocean City this summer.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. News Director, Eugene Son. Our Assistant News Director, Katie Culinary. John Mussoni, Assistant Vice President for News Operations. Our engineers this week, Bob Alls, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great Memorial Day weekend. I'm Tom McDonald for Newsworks Tonight.